Hello, and welcome to Presenting, a podcast where we chat about various topics related to role-playing games, typically Paizo products such as Pathfinder and Starfinder, but also others. I'm John Godek, and with me today is Mark Seifter. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, John.
So, Mark is the design manager for Paizo and was one of the four leads in creating the Pathfinder 2nd Edition and part of the original team that created Starfinder. In addition, Mark is a freelance author of numerous Paizo products and co-hosts a gaming Twitch stream called Arcane Mark. So, Mark, can you tell us a little bit about your job as a design manager, what that entails? Because I'm not actually quite sure.
Oh, and sure thing.
And tell us how this might relate to developers and authors and kind of the other folks that work on games.
Sure. And actually, there's an episode about in Arcane Mark that's all about the different positions at Paizo and how we do things, because it's honestly not the same as I think any other company uses some of those titles. It's very idiosyncratic. So at Paizo, when something is being created, sometimes it will be designed in-house, like a new class for the Advanced Player's Guide. And those are something that the designers are going to design. But typically, we will send it to freelancers who are the authors that you mentioned, who will write an adventure or write some other content and then send those in to us. And so at that point in the process, the work comes into the hands of either the designers for some of the more rules heavy content or developers who are going to sort of improve the content and check it carefully to make sure it fits in with the space that's available, with some of the other themes, that it doesn't overlap with what another freelancer did, or in the case of a story, if it's an adventure path, that it connects to the other adventure paths correctly, and all sorts of other little things that happen along the way. At that point, it gets sent to the editors, who will check the language and styles to make sure that they're consistent with the way Paizo does things, and to the art team, who are going to lay it out. Then it goes back to the designer or developer for some copy fitting to make sure it fits on the page on the right space, and then back to the editors to bring it home with some additional editing, more or less. There are a lot of other steps, and my longer Arcane Mark episode goes into what all of those are, but that's sort of the broad strokes what designers and developers do. Designers are more rulesy, might design new rules. Developers are sort of like the producer for a movie and the director in some ways too, where they're going to get this story or this product from start to finish with just a huge variety of skill set. As the design manager, that means that I am not only a designer, but also responsible for helping to manage the basically sort of like a mini project manager for the projects the design team is dealing with, figure out how our designers are being utilized, what our time frame is, if we're under the gun with too many projects, like where we should focus our efforts to make sure that everything is getting to those editors at the time that it needs to as best we can, or to the freelancers enough information for them to continue in their work.
And so as design manager, do you basically work on all the products, or do you focus on just a couple of them?
So as the design manager, sort of in theory, I am managing the efforts of anyone who is fully on the design team across products. And I don't have a Pathfinder or a Starfinder in front of the right word design manager, in the same way that you might see that Logan is the Pathfinder lead designer, which means that he takes a critical eye to everything in the Pathfinder line to make sure that there's a consistency there, right? Mm-hmm. But because of some of the way that Starfinder sort of does things and has had an outgrowth from Pathfinder, it's not necessarily the case that I will always do as much on the Starfinder side because I wind up doing a lot of Pathfinder design directly. But occasionally, I've occasionally done some things like with surveys to help support Joe Piscini, who is the Starfinder lead designer as well.
And what about the adventure card game?
So the adventure card game as a design is designed by Loan Shark, which is a separate company that's licensed a licensee. So they've got their own designers and developers who design and develop the card game, and they use the word designer and developer probably more similarly to other companies rather than Paizo, where they don't have freelancers, so the designers do the initial design and the developers put it through the rules through its paces. But the adventure card game does have an adventure card society, which is sort of an organized play program for it. And those stories are developed at Paizo. So there's a lot of interplay between Paizo and Loan Shark on the game, but the design and development is all Loan Shark.
Can you talk a little bit about your journey for arriving at your design manager position now? It sounds, you mentioned there's quite a bit of project management involved. That's not something you would maybe typically pick up as a freelance author, though you obviously have to know how to manage your time and whatnot.
Yeah, that's definitely true. So, I didn't really start mainly as a freelance author before working at Paizo. I definitely had been a freelance author of several projects, but I actually sort of if yeah, and people may have heard this like a few years ago, 6 years ago now, when I joined Paizo, but I was working on my PhD at MIT in artificial intelligence, and the job position, Sean K. Reynolds' job position as a designer at Paizo opened up. So I just decided to apply. I wasn't really sure that I was going to make it past the resume stage. I had a few freelance projects. I'd never written for Paizo before, but I was also a very prolific GM and volunteer for Pathfinder Society organized play, and had guides I had written for the community on Pathfinder First Edition game, and had participated in play tests before. And like during the Magus play test, I created a compilation thread where I tried to encourage people to like give real play test feedback for the team rather than just always putting down their theories only. I was like, the theories are good, but let's give some play test feedback that Jason had taken note of at that time. I'm sure he didn't remember, but I mentioned it on my resume. And so I did make it past the resume stage, probably not as a top person who made it past the resume stage, but I made it to the blind test that Paizo gives out of skill, and I crushed that test. So, and then made it to the interview, and the rest is history in terms of becoming a designer. However, the reason I call back to that is that it turns out project management, in a way, has a lot of parallels with computer system design and certain principles of computer science. When you want to get something to work really efficiently in a program or in a computer system, you have to consider sort of, what processes are running, what's the limiting process, and what order things have to be performed in for different steps when you give them right to different parts of the computer. And that's also how things work in a company to an extent. And so a lot of the same skill sets and mathematical analysis that can be performed as a computer scientist are actually turned out to be really helpful for project and time management analyses for the team. And so I was able to use those skills already somewhat as a designer, but when my title was just designer, it was like, well, you're doing this, but are we gonna use this necessarily? But so it was a no-brainer for Jason when Logan and I were getting some new titles to have me take that project management role, and have Logan take the role as the lead designer who's going to curate for Pathfinder.
So, you were working on your PhD at MIT in artificial intelligence. That's quite a change to what you're doing now. Did you imagine you would be doing game design when you're going through your program there?
Well, I mean, when I was really little, I thought, oh, yeah, I'll design games. Probably I was thinking video games at the time. But when I was working on AI, I didn't really necessarily think that I was actually going to be designing, like being a big part in designing Starfinder and Pathfinder Second Edition. That's certainly not the case. But there's more similarities than you might think. Obviously, it depends on which sort of tack you're taking in AI. But a lot of what I was researching on was on language and the use of stories in learning. And so there's actually a lot of overlap there with sort of RPGs and a collaborative storytelling that you find in them.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can imagine that it's a big change, though, in terms of the type of environment, though. Is it a bit more relaxed at Paizo than it was at MIT, or is it pretty laid back?
It's a lot less relaxed.
Oh, that's no good. So
there's tons of deadlines and tons and tons and tons of things to do, and not usually enough people for all the tasks. So it comes down to, like, these are people who we all have a major passion for games and for Pathfinder and for everything that's going on. And hopefully that can help get through some pretty tough and intense situations. But no, I would say that it's more intense in the publishing industry.
Wow. So it's more intense working at Paizo than getting a PhD in AI at MIT. That's what you're saying.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, so I did a PhD at Michigan, and I would say there's a lot of flexibility in terms of how long you want to work on things and what you spend time on, and you're holding yourself more accountable. There's not a lot of external deadlines except when your funding runs out and you finally have to graduate, kind of thing. Yeah, I can see where you have a lot of external deadlines. It becomes a big issue. It's just seeing the differences there. I guess I wouldn't think about that kind of on the surface. So,
oh yeah, definitely. I mean, if you just ask someone what they thought, they would not have said that, I think. But it turns out it's just based on there being a lot of work and few people for the work, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that's part of my analysis as the design manager, is to say, well, there's this amount of work and we have this amount of people, and the amount of people is usually less than the amount of work. So, like, if you had a lot of people, maybe it wouldn't be as intense.
But unfortunately, from what I've heard, the margins aren't so great that you can just keep hiring more and more people. Unfortunately,
you are absolutely right on that. So, I know that Jason, the director of game design, did some analysis that showed that just those small pamphlets that were put out with the original Dungeons and Dragons rules cost a significant percentage, even without accounting for inflation, of what our giant hundreds of page books with color print and all sorts of fancier art are now costing. I can't remember off the top of my head how much it was, but if you adjust for inflation, like, the RPG industry has just not been keeping up with pricing. But it requires about as much expertise in a subject to get, of how great the freelancers and the developers and the editors and everybody have to be technical skill as a textbook. And it definitely is not being priced like a textbook. And that is going to, exactly as you said, make it so that the margins are not always great. I mean, the joke in the RPG industry that I heard a lot in before joining was, how do you make a large fortune in the RPG industry? Or sorry, I messed it up. How do you make a small fortune in the RPG industry? The answer is you start with a large fortune.
Right.
And that's sort of what it is. It's passion as love of the game. But it definitely means that if you have a big success, it's still going to be a success. But if you make a mistake on a product, the margins are so thin, you probably took a loss on that one, right? And I don't know the exact specifics on anything, but that just seems to me, with those kind of margins, that it could be a possibility.
Well, it's interesting. You know, you mentioned that kind of the textbook industry, and I happen to be a university professor, and that's one of the big complaints the students have is typically a new textbook is running between, you know, $150 to $300, and they're kind of a captive audience and have to pay it. You don't have the same issue with RPGs. There's so many different ones that, you know, people can buy. And even if they want a particular one, there's so much downward pressure on the pricing. You know,
huge downward pressure.
Yeah. I mean, you look at the core, like the Pathfinder 2 core book is about the size of a typical textbook. That book would cost about $300 as a textbook. And when you look at the print run, you know, a typical textbook print run is about maybe $2,000, $3,000 for an average textbook. And that's why they justify the higher prices. Now, you guys do a much bigger print run, but I don't think it's that much bigger, you know, initially.
I don't know the details exactly of print runs, but what I have heard is once it gets high enough, then you don't get much better margins for going higher than that. But those are all non-numerical, vague statements that people who know more about print runs have said. But, and I'm certainly not saying that the textbooks are not out there on the other side of being high. But the fact that that both textbooks and RPGs are going to take a huge amount of expertise from every step of the process, and that the RPGs often have also more expensive art, really showcases the difference. Like, yeah, if the core rulebook is one-fifth to one-sixth the price of a textbook, maybe both of them should be half the price of what the textbook is, or what have you. But the problem is that there's huge downward pressure, and the whole industry, in a sense, has gone to that downward pressure. And some of it is just the fact that that's what the industry leaders are doing. And some of it is the fact that for the smaller publishers, in many cases, they might have another job and they just love the game so much. They want to make a cool product and have it maybe pay back for the art, but not for their time on it or what have you, right, with the product. And so they don't have to price it as high either. So it's a complicated situation, and it's one that I have some perspective on, but I'm sure that would be fascinating for someone with like an economics degree to sort through.
Yeah, no, it's definitely something. I've been following, you know, Owen Casey Stevens talks quite a bit about the industry, and it's really interesting learning more about that, because my background's in business and I don't understand the business model right now. It seems to run counter to so many other industries, and it's just kind of it's an interesting thing to look at. Anyway, moving on. So you were on the ground floor of both Starfinder and Pathfinder Second Edition. Can you talk about your experiences with each of those, and maybe compare those experiences, how they differ, how they might have been similar?
Sure. There are a lot of similarities in some ways, in that in both cases, you're designing a new game. Usually when you're designing a new game, every step takes longer than you thought, because you have to iterate multiple times and you have a very pressing deadline for when that product just has to be done. So it definitely can be some of the most hectic of all times when you're designing games, and that was definitely true for both. Can be very rewarding too, and offer certain opportunities in terms of just really getting to shape the direction of where the game is going. So there were definitely a lot of differences in that Starfinder had sort of this legacy connection to Pathfinder First Edition, and it had a lot of conflicting goals that were very interesting, and restrictions can sometimes breed creativity in that regard. There was definitely a time when it seemed like some of the goals that Starfinder was shooting for like might not have been mathematically possible to achieve, particularly with the idea that you can run any Pathfinder first edition monster and the math is going to line up, even though full attacks are completely different and everything is completely different. I remember when Logan and I were crunching all that out, and I wasn't sure that the answer would be that there is a solution. And then I came back, I was like, I found one. They have to do exactly this at exactly these times. But if we do that, it should line up with the Starfinder ban that let you use the legacy monsters, which was one of the mandates that it did. And it was just sort of a fun mathematical moment of like, has to go with exactly this progression, and we have to get like some kind of an item that gives you an attack bonus that comes in at this particular level, because otherwise that level could have some issues there. But it was just like mapping two very incompatible mathematical models onto each other, but getting them to be compatible was pretty fun and challenging and interesting. But in a way, Pathfinder 2nd Edition was more freeing because we did not have to do that.
So it was like a clean slate with 2nd Edition. You had the lore, but in terms of the mechanics, you could do what you wanted.
Not completely. There were definitely certain mechanical aspects that were just sort of too legacy to the feel of the game, because it wasn't just the lore and the story that needed to stay the same. It also needed to sort of feel like those same elements were there in the game. And so there was a sense that you didn't want to make a lot of unnecessary changes. Like if you change the name of Fireball to Sphere of the Inferno or something like that, the lore would probably be fine that people were throwing Spheres of the Inferno around, but there's just no reason to do that. So you generally, when you're making a change to the mechanics that might affect the feel of play, you'd want to justify it with some kind of advantage, and Sphere of the Inferno wouldn't have any advantage necessarily. Now, you could have a situation with certain spells if they were OGL, where it would be like, well, but this name is OGL, and so you might want to change it for that reason, which is sort of a licensing reason, but Fireball is just a word. So that one, I use that example because there's really no reason to change it. And so you kind of had to justify, okay, we're changing the way the fundamental math works because it leads to some very unsatisfying situations where you just, your rogue is never going to be good at fortitude or will save without using weird tricks. You just aren't in first edition because you get six less from your base progression than people who have a strong fortitude or will save. And that's a huge difference. And then that's going to be compounded with the fact that wisdom isn't your ability score against certain characters. So we knew that led to a play dynamic disparity that was an issue. And so it would be worth it to adjust the math. While also adjusting math is less likely to be a front-end concern that is going to make people feel that it plays differently because it's sort of on the back end. Whereas, say, the sorcerer change, which I was not sure people would like, but they did, I proposed, hey, sorcerers get their blood from all sorts of different types of creatures, so what if we just have them cast from whatever tradition the creature their blood is from? They can do all four types of magic. And at first I thought that maybe the other designers would be like, what? But I wasn't sure because designers like to tinker and try new things, and the other designers thought, that's cool, let's ask other people at the company. I thought maybe other people at the company are really invested, and they're not going to want celestial sorcerers to be divine. They might want them to still be arcane. But then people at the company were like, that's awesome, let's try it. And I was like, well, the fans, though, they're not going to be happy with this, are they? And then the fans voted on the surveys. 90% of people, I think just barely, said that they really like the new thing with sorcerers. So sometimes you do something that you know is a change that you just think it's cool, so people will like it, or you hope that people will like it, and sometimes they do. And that was pretty satisfying when it happened.
Now, with Pathfinder 2nd Edition, you had a public playtest where you could get feedback, but with Starfinder, that kind of flew under the radar, and then just came out at Gen Con and was a big hit. Was there a difference in terms of the development time, or did you have a not enough time to do that sort of thing with Starfinder, or did you just not want to do that then, or, you know, why the difference, I guess?
It was definitely, if I recall, it was even publicly stated that there just wasn't enough time to do one. And but that doesn't mean there wasn't an extensive internal playtest.
Right.
But my internal playtesters were crazily dedicated to playtesting it to an extent that I did not expect. We played 12 out of 14 days during an intensive period when we needed more playtest results. That is a lot. We made it through during that time, all of part one and part two of a Starfinder version of Rise of the Rune Lords, and a significant portion of the beginning of part three. Just all during that short period of time in little spurts of what we could do after work on every day.
Wow.
It was called Ryza of the Space Lords, and it was just literally space versions of everything from Rise of the Rune Lords, with like just random things like Magmar 4, the monument planet, and also volcanoes instead of Magnemar, which was ruled by Grobar the Hutt, who was like Lord Mayor Grobaras from Magnemar, and things like that.
Who runs the playtest typically? Who GMs it?
What do you mean?
Well, when you do it in-house, you have a GM that's running it. Does it just pass around, or, you know, does Jason Bullman run all the Pathfinder stuff, or, you know, what? I'm just kind of curious.
Usually when we're in an in-house playtest period, multiple people will be running. So I was running for all NDA people who were not from Paizo, except Linda. During that Starfinder playtest. During Pathfinder 2nd Edition playtest, there were also a lot of different groups, but we did do one official group that was just all of the design team plus one additional non-designer going through all of Doomsday Dawn with Logan running it. But that was just sort of like who was available at the time. And also Logan knew Doomsday Dawn the best because he had done a pass behind James Jacobs on most of the sections. So he was already spoiled for some of the things. Obviously, Steven, Jason wrote some of the sections, and so they knew their section, or at least before it was through with you know, James and Logan and so on. But still, it made sense to have one GM do that particular playtest. But even still, there were numerous other playtests during the Pathfinder playtest going on. Like, I had one I was running of Shattered Star that Luis Loza was playing a shield using fighter after his first fighter got killed, who wound up being the picture of the Bastion in the Advanced Player's Guide.
So when you mentioned that you had some NDA playtests too, so you actually bring people from outside to playtest?
For those internal playtests, that'll sometimes happen. It just depends on how many playtesters they're looking for, and there's some NDAs, and there's I think a few handfuls of internal playtesters. It's just mostly based on who's available for an internal playtest, but the internal playtests are also very different depending on the situation or the time, so I would say none of them is really exactly the same as any of the others.
So in addition to your design work, you have numerous freelance credits for Paizo. What advice do you have for people interested in doing freelance work for RPGs?
Well, I can definitely give advice about doing freelance work for RPGs, but definitely not give advice to follow the path that I did to get freelance credits for Paizo, because that was never writing for Paizo and then working for Paizo and getting freelance credits that way. But when you're a freelancer for RPGs, the important thing to know is that if you have an idea and you're really passionate about it, there's probably a third-party publisher out there who will publish it for you. I mean, not just for you, they'll publish it with you, and you're going to get usually a cut rather than a flat rate, because a flat rate is, can be, for the reasons we discussed earlier, risky, but you might get a flat rate. And once you've published out a corpus of work, then you could show those or give examples of those and get a job at Paizo or another sort of bigger name in the industry. And it's basically, it's just like, it's not as mystical or hard as you might sort of build it up to be. If you know that you have the skills, even just the skills to, like in Pathfinder First Edition, the skills to be a GM from level 1 to 20 and custom tailor your adventures to not, to work with your party all the way up to those higher levels is probably enough skills that if you also have a good grasp of the English language, that you could write something cool for a third party publisher, because that game was very difficult to run to high levels successfully, but very, very rewarding if you could. Or I guess is, not was.
Well, how's Pathfinder Second Edition gonna look at the high levels? Is it gonna be challenging, easy to run? What do you think?
Well, I mean, we want it to be easy to run and still have all that fun and feeling of being super high level. And we can't say for certain, except for I've been reading reports online from people who played Age of Ashes up to level 20, who got up to the highest levels in games, that it's been running smoothly and much more easily. And it has not been sort of this case in Pathfinder First Edition, where if you just kind of naively run it without making some adjustments, it's going to bust apart. Not to say that Pathfinder First Edition falls apart at high levels automatically. It doesn't. If you have a GM who knows just what to do and can tailor things for their group, it can be an absolute blast. And I've talked before in places about how, for my group, when we were running the end of Jade Regent, they were all level 16, I think. And so I had them fight four CR20 mythic Onis, a level 20 samurai with some ridiculous other stuff, a level 18 oracle, and a level 17 ninja. And then one of the Onis got into a final form that was even more powerful that they directly had to fight after that. And yeah, they won it really, really easily for the most part, but there were some tense moments during it because I gave some really unfair abilities to some of the mythic Oni that they were fighting. Now, if you look at the book, it's going to tell you no way should you throw four CR20 mythic Onis at a group of level 16 characters, let alone a level 20 samurai with PC wealth and an 18 oracle and all of those other things. But if you know your group, you can have some really epic moments in Pathfinder First. In Pathfinder Second, you can usually run it by the book. At least I found in my game, which I ran up to level 17, War for the Crown, and people seem to be funny online. And it'll work and it'll be fun.
Yeah, that's interesting. I do primarily Starfinder, and so I'm really curious to see what the top end of that looks like. Right now the highest that we're typically going is level 12, and that still by the book is pretty straightforward. And I've done a little bit of work helping test out some 18 to 20, and that seems still to fit pretty tight. So I'm curious to see
I
how
think
to
it
help.
will. When we were designing Starfinder, we definitely had like getting those higher levels to work better in mind, and some of the math scaling in Starfinder helps with that. And obviously, having six levels of spellcasters instead of nine, in some ways can help with that too. So I'm guessing that Starfinder probably sits somewhere in between the two, but closer to second edition in terms of it working more similarly with what's in the book without as much adjustment.
So, last month we actually the end of last month, early this month, we had Gen Con online due to the pandemic. How did you find the online con experience as compared to like a typical Gen Con?
It was honestly pretty similar to PaizoCon online, in a sense. And both of those were kind of different from both Gen Con and regular PaizoCon too, because, well, one of the main things is it was definitely less. I just say less without an adjective afterwards, because it was less like sort of exhausting and physically demanding on me, but it was also less exciting from just the faces and the joy and excitement and happiness of the fans at Gen Con. Seeing how much they love the thing that I worked on is very energizing and good. Whereas some of the like the amount of working Gen Con and just standing out there and tearing down the booth and things like that can be very demanding. And it was nice to be, just in our house after the thing that we did and not having all of that. So it was a little bit bittersweet in that sense, because I do really, really like seeing the reactions of the fans, and it's worth it for all the extra effort that we have to put out at Gen Con. But I try to find the silver lining.
Yeah, I kind of had a similar experience. I mean, you were involved in some panels, and we had those, at the actual Gen Con and in PaizoCon in the past. But it's the gameplay for me that was like so different. Typically at the big cons, you're just running around and you're just run ragged. And here, doing it online and not having a lot of other demands on me besides just GMing was a lot more refreshing. I was not near as wore out after 4 days of GMing as I would be at Gen Con, because you're not talking to people in between things and doing
Right.
stuff.
Yeah, I'd say that's a good summary. Not as worn out, but also not as energized, which sounds like it's a contradiction, but with that whole explanation, I think it makes sense.
Yeah, I definitely miss seeing people though. That's the big downside to that, 'cause the big cons, there's some people I only see at Gen Con or Origins. They don't travel a lot of other places other than those. So kind of miss interacting with them face to face. So
Yeah.
what's next for Mark? What's on your plate? What's coming down the road for Arcane Mark? What's coming down the road for maybe stuff you're working on at Paizo or whatever? What's going on with you?
Well, Arcane Mark continues to have episodes that are voted for by sort of by the viewers of the show. So by the time this is on air, all of the episodes I currently know about that are going to be up on Arcane Mark will have been already happened. And it's sort of an adventure, and we don't know what it's going to happen on the show more than 2 weeks in the future. But it's in that way, it's sort of an RPG variety show. We do, GM tools episodes that are very popular, and player tools with like tips for improving your experience at the game. We do episodes that are just like sort of retellings of some of the ways that we ran through famous adventure paths and other adventures that are like the Linda's adventures and Mark's adventures. We do workshops that are building a brand new monster or deity or things like that. So it's just whatever people vote for in the vote that's going on during the episode is what happens there.
And where can people find out more about those and what's your schedule?
It's twitch.tv/arcanemark. And we have the schedule down. It's just underneath the top sort of the what is it? The video that's not running, right? That's at the top. If you go right underneath it, it shows the schedule and a bunch of links to all sorts of useful places, such as our Discord, and our Discord, our Patreon page, things like that. So Arcane Mark, I don't know what'll be going on, but when it comes to Paizo work. Well, we've got a lot of cool products coming up. Obviously, with the Advanced Player's Guide coming out, the next one is Beginner Box, which we have completely turned over. And in fact, anyone who's watching all the streams at Gen Con has been able to see like a prototype copy that I think Eric and Jason had during some of the streams, which is pretty rad. Right after that is going to be Bestiary 3. That's what we're working on trying to finish off right now as this is being taped. And I really hope by the time that this comes out that we will have finished that off. And then there's the newly announced Secrets of Magic, which by the time this episode is out, you all will probably be playtesting the Summoner and the Mingus as we speak. So those two classes are definitely going to be a lot of fun, and I hope that you're enjoying them right now as you listen to this podcast. But working on that book is going to take a lot of our attention moving forward from the Best Area 3.
Excellent. Well, Mark, thanks so much for joining us on the podcast today.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.